Okay, so let me start with a quote from that well-known risk-taker, Jim Morrison, who, having gone to a roadhouse and got himself a beer, said, "The future's uncertain and the end is always near." So that's what I want to talk about today, is uncertainty and the role of risk and uncertainty in the financial crisis. And the primary reason why I want to do that, beyond this being a risk conference, is that I believe risk assessment, or more precisely, risk misassessment, has been one of the key elements of the crisis. So while that's undoubtedly true in any crisis, I think it's played a more central role in this episode than it has in the past. So risk was misassessed by financial institutions, by risk managers, by investors, and by regulators. There was a false comfort taken from a misplaced belief that risk was being accurately and appropriately measured. To some extent, the technology provided risk managers with a false sense of security. Risk may well have been accurately measured for the particular regime that the economy and financial markets were operating in, but the risk assessment was clearly not robust to a regime change that took the models out of their historical comfort zone. More importantly, I think, not enough account was taken of uncertainty. So one of the messages I want to try and leave you with today is that risk measurement based on historical models can only take you so far. Judgment must play an important role. Ultimately, the future is uncertain in the sense that it can't be quantified. The goal should be to design systems for the financial markets that are as robust as possible to this uncertainty, and a system with less leverage is one obvious means of enhancing robustness. So in discussing risk, I would like to highlight the key distinction between risk and uncertainty. So the way I look at it is, risk is quantifiable, uncertainty is not. This is a distinction with a long tradition. Keynes made much of it, as did Frank Knight, who lends his name to Knightian uncertainty. So Knightian uncertainty, if you don't know, arises when you don't know the underlying probability distribution, which makes quantifying the risks impossible. More recently, this distinction has been given popular prominence by Donald Rumsfeld with his knowns and unknowns, as well as by Sajid Das in Traders, Guns and Money, and particularly more recently Nassim Taleb in The Black Swan. So in addition to who are basically, I think, reinventing what Keynes and Knight were writing about in the earlier part of the 20th century. In addition to the distinction between risk and uncertainty in terms of measurability, Keynes made the similar distinction between cardinal and ordinal probability. So cardinal probability is quantifiable. The probability of heads in a coin flip is 50%. Ordinal probability is qualitative. For example, and as much as it pains me to say this, the Collingwood are more likely to win the premiership this year than Carlton. How much more likely they are to win, I couldn't tell you. I can just tell you they're more likely to win. And this is coming from a Carlton supporter, so it's a fairly unbiased assessment. Model-based risk management handles cardinal probability a lot better than it handles ordinal probability. So in the period prior to the onset of the crisis, a hubris developed in parts of the financial sector that everything could be precisely measured and priced, in particular that risk was always quantifiable. The quants of the world were on this quest, much like Lancelot was on the quest for the Holy Grail, to find the truth, the ultimate data-generating process, which I don't believe is actually out there. I'm not saying that the quest for improved measurability was misplaced. There was a lot of progress made in better understanding the way financial markets operate and enhancing the technology of risk assessment. The problem was that the management of risk proved to be too narrow. The focus tended to be on things that were quantifiable to the exclusion of those that were not. Some risks were treated as cardinal, even though they were actually ordinal. Some risks, such as liquidity risk and rollover risk, were neglected completely. Moreover, the risk assessment was often based on too short a history that did not include a set of observations relevant to the events that were actually unfolding. Comfort was taken in the precision of the measurement without thinking enough about the measurement itself. That is, not enough judgment was exercised. Indeed, at times it seems to have been turned off. So a key question to ask is, were the events of the past 3 years unpredictable or too uncertain? That's the question I'll come back to in a minute. But I don't want to get too Rumsfeldian here, but an important element of risk management is to know what you don't know. But unfortunately, even that is not good enough. From a risk point of view, ultimately, you need to be able to measure what you don't know. That, I believe, is inherently impossible. Because it is impossible, we should make society as robust as possible to uncertainty while realising it is not possible to insulate it completely from uncertainty. So a critical issue is how important is all of this? Now, to some extent, the last 3 years answer that question, but anyhow, the answer is it depends on the circumstances. In the good times, not being able to quantify the risk of the unknowable downside or take into account the uncertainties is not that important while ever the good times last. Indeed, there is little to be gained from doing so. Every once in a while, however, it becomes the main game. So the great moderation of the 1990s and 2000s lulled investors and risk managers into a false sense of security. The decline in volatility led many to conclude that a new, more stable regime had been established. Let me make it clear that I am not saying that the stable macro environment of this period was a bad thing. Far from it. The improvement in welfare generated by the low unemployment rate, stable growth and low inflation was large and welcome. So I don't subscribe to the somewhat Austrian view that the stability and decline in volatility sowed the seeds of its own destruction. So models could do a good job of measuring what was taking place during the Great Moderation. The models were also doing a good job of out-of-sample prediction through that time. The models were being continually refined and became more complex, taking advantage of the improvement in computing power to analyse price movements and discrepancies at a higher and higher frequency. But the underlying data was still assumed to come from the one stable data-generating process that the quants of this world are eternally searching for. The problem came when the future unfolded in a way that was no longer consistent with the history used to develop these models. So this raises the questions of whether things would have been different if a more appropriate history had been used in the estimation, or is that simply a pipe dream? So what is the right history? Is it different this time? So as Reinhardt and Rogoff have put it, this time is different is the excuse which is always used when there is a major shock to the status quo. However, a careful reading of Reinhardt and Rogoff shows that while the general themes often repeat themselves, unfortunately, history doesn't repeat exactly. Things are different enough to matter. History can inform, but ultimately it's only a guide. History is not a forecast. So history obviously plays a prominent role in risk assessment. History shapes the models used, as well as the data underpinning them. But what is the relevant history that should be taken into account in the risk assessment? So I'll answer this question using value-at-risk models as an example, though I'm not meaning to single these out, well, not completely, as the same issues arise with all models. So VAR models draw observations from a defined period of time, which is generally not all that long. As observations are realised, the model is further refined. If observations start to be realised, which lie outside the distribution of the VAR, it is updated to account of that, imparting somewhat of a pro-cyclicality to the process. If the short time period used to estimate the model is an unrepresentative guide to what is about to unfold, then VAR has a serious problem. But in an era of reduced volatility, like the Great Moderation, the shortness of the time period was not so much the issue. Indeed, a longer data sample would still have generated similar outcomes as long as it lay within the period of the Great Moderation. Rather, the problem was the misplaced expectation that volatility was permanently reduced. This was then combined with the belief that the distinction between uncertainty and risk was no longer particularly relevant. That is, the belief was that while the future was still unknowable, it was still likely to lie within the distribution of the recent past. There supposedly had been a regime change, which meant that the earlier, more volatile period of history was no longer relevant. But how much history should be relevant? That's a difficult question to ask, although it is a question which should always be asked. So when one is looking at financial market pricing, should one include observations from the 1920s, when the structure of financial markets was markedly different, or when the policy reaction function then is completely different to what it is today? So in that regard, it's interesting to read Lords of Finance and gain an insight into the mindset of the policymakers at the time. We would like to think that we have learnt from the history and hence that the policy responses today have been conditioned by those lessons. Although given that the Germans experienced hyperinflation and the US experienced the Great Depression, the lessons that those two countries have learnt from the Great Depression, the 1920s, may be quite different and somewhat reflected in their responses today. But given that we have learnt, the 1920s may not be relevant to model estimation today because there has been a major structural change. So perhaps history can be too long as well as too short. Similar arguments can be brought to bear on stress tests, which can be used to assess the robustness of a model or a risk management regime to a set of outcomes that lie outside the data history of the model. Stress testing can go beyond out-of-sample forecasting. One can conceive of a scenario which is not consistent completely with the model. Nevertheless, a similar question can be asked. What is the universe of events that should be considered in my stress test? To take an extreme, should I stress test my model against the prospect of nuclear Armageddon? It would seem extreme to do so now, but maybe in the 1950s it wouldn't have been such a tail event. To take perhaps a more recent, relevant recent example, in the US, financial institutions, credit rating agencies and investors stress tested their mortgage portfolios and mortgage-backed securities. This is pre-2007. However, the stress test was derived from the history of house prices in the US. That history suggested that cities in the US had their own price cycles and that the correlations across housing markets across the country was not particularly strong. Periods of large house price decline were confined to a few idiosyncratic events in a few cities. One could obviously have stressed the mortgages assuming some moderate nationwide house price decline, that is, assuming that one spreadsheet actually allowed you to stick in a negative number for house prices, which supposedly one rating agency's spreadsheets didn't allow. And indeed, a number of the AAA rated securities would not have maintained their rating under such a scenario. But given the history prior to 2007, would a stress test of a nationwide 20% decline in house prices have been considered plausible? Probably not, but that's actually what occurred. Now, having seen that history, banks stress test their resilience to it, because it is an event that is in the recent experience. But what heretofore unconceived event will they be vulnerable to in the future? The answer, of course, is that it's impossible to tell. So an important part of the solution from a regulatory point of view is to make the system as robust as possible to such events. So let me now turn to some issues surrounding the design of a system that can be made more robust to uncertainty. So a primary step in making the system more robust is to be using the right models. It sort of goes without saying. But using a number of models at the same time is probably going to be helpful too. But the point I've been trying to make is that while that's a commendable objective, what is right in one set of circumstances may not be right in another. A healthy dose of judgment needs to be applied to the model-based analysis. We might be comfortable in having an overall framework that is robust to these changes in circumstance, but it may well not be possible to distill that framework down to a set of quantifiable models that can be used in practice. Hence, the aim is to make the system robust, whatever the right model. So as my colleague at the Bank of England, Andy Haldane, has highlighted, leverage is a critical factor in making the financial system less robust to uncertainty. Andy shows that leverage played the major role in translating events which would have been somewhat damaging but survivable into events which were fatal. Leverage obviously increases the returns to bets which pay off, but it simultaneously increases the losses from bets that do not. Financial institutions had made the assessment that the leverage that they were carrying was not fatal. Their models told them it was not fatal, and thus there were draws from the extreme tails of the model's distribution. Unfortunately, as David Vinyar, CFO of Goldman Sachs, put it, we were seeing events that were 25 standard deviation moves several days in a row. He said that in August 2007. The tails continued to get fatter and fatter through at least the next year. The goals of making the financial system more robust to uncertainty is one of the key motivations behind the reforms being finalised in Basel at the moment. It is worthwhile to note that the Basel reforms are primarily focused at the institutional level. That is, the idea is to make the system robust to an idiosyncratic institutional shock. This includes measures designed to limit the leverage of financial institutions and deliver a more robust funding structure and enhance capital buffers. While these measures work to increase the robustness at an institutional level, in the event of a system-wide event, such as took place in 2008, a different set of considerations come into play. Once a systemic shock of that nature occurs, it requires a systemic response, which ultimately must come from the public sector, including the central bank, which has the capacity to respond. So I don't believe it is socially optimal for the individual entity to fully insure itself. It would be excessively costly for the financial sector to hold enough capital and liquidity to enable it to survive a freezing of capital markets of the type that occurred in 2008. At some point, it's not even affordable. Financial services are a key intermediary input into the production process. a severe curtailment of those services has a material impact on the capital accumulation process, unemployment and the long-run growth prospects of the economy. It is in the interest of society to ensure that the public sector provides a backstop in such circumstances to mitigate the externality caused by the individually rational risk aversion of financial sector participants. So let me move to a conclusion. What I've been trying to get across today is that the misassessment of risk has been a key element of the financial crisis. One of the contributing factors to this misassessment was an over-reliance on a model-based approach to risk management, which focused too much on measurable risk without taking full enough account of unmeasurable uncertainty. Taking account of uncertainty is not easy. After all, it is uncertain. But at least a focus on ordinal as well as cardinal probabilities would surely be beneficial. This can be done by stress testing with scenarios that fall outside the model's history. But stress testing and the assessment of uncertainty is still constrained by the difficult decision as to what the relevant set of stresses that the framework should be subjected to and what is the relevant history. A healthy dose of judgment needs to be brought to bear on those decisions. Given the difficulties, it is important to make the system as robust as possible to the inherent irreducible uncertainty. And one key element of this, I believe, is restraining leverage, which can limit the number of illnesses that turn into fatalities. So I've started with a quote from Jim Morrison, so let me finish off with one and just say this is the end.
So. Phil Lasker from the ABC, Dr. DeBell. I'll get the ball rolling. I'm going to ask you to use a healthy dose of judgment yourself here. We're seeing some rather troubling statistics out of the United States. We've just had our reporting period in Australia, and I detected an increase in conservatism in the corporate sector as companies were strengthening balance sheets, reducing debt, taking a more risk-averse approach to the landscape or the and in particular the global landscape. So given all this, what do you think, how do you assess the risk of a double-dip recession globally?
I didn't really want to talk about the macro conjecture. I didn't want to talk more about the talk, but anyhow. I think it's a risk. It's actually a somewhat unquantifiable risk. It's a risk. I mean, one thing which is, it's difficult. It's difficult to take into account risk and uncertainty in structuring balance sheets and the like. It's difficult to take risk and uncertainty into account in conducting policy. To some extent in policy, you have to take account of the modal events rather than the tail events, which means that you're probably going to be wrong, but you just don't know in which direction you're actually going to be wrong. At the moment, uncertainty is probably elevated, has been for the last few years, which just makes all decision-making a lot more difficult.
I really want you to perhaps say something about we call risk managers the doves and those that want to use the leverage the hawks. How would you envisage these hawks and doves clashing or working together?
That's a very good question. I think one thing which has been interesting to see is that that the risk managers have been given a more elevated position in institutions, so that they report either the chief risk officer, which is a position which didn't even used to exist all that long ago, is now given a position often at a much higher level, hopefully at least at the executive level, with a direct report to a company's board. Now we're probably all of this is probably cyclical. We're in a phase of the cycle at the moment where risk managers are in the ascendancy. At some point, somewhere down the track, we'll probably be in the phase of the cycle like we were 4 or 5 years ago when they're not clearly not in the ascendancy. And obviously, if you read accounts of the last few years, you read of plenty of reports where risk managers did indeed warn about the risks that institutions were taken and then were generally fired. In a number of cases. I think that's always going to be part of the culture. But to try and embed it slightly more strongly in the structure is obviously a good aim. How resilient that's going to be to the good times is not entirely clear. So I think that's always a difficulty. I suppose it's something potentially, at least on the financial institution side, is something that regulators can try and monitor, that it is the case that, you know, risk managers are part of the executive, that they're listened to and not summarily ignored at the wrong time. But that is, you know, that's a difficult question, which, and as I said, does have a cyclical element to it. So it's not a problem at the moment. It's probably going to be a problem in 5 or 6 years' time again.
Jeff Rogo at Dow Jones. Given a lot of people in this room take a little micro approach to Australia, one of the big risks we've heard people talk about is the housing market. Given some of your thoughts in April regarding securitization markets and the difference between some of the have-nots and haves in the home lending market, I want to know what your thoughts are now in modeling Australia's housing market, as we've had some investors globally be quite naysayers to what's been pretty certain growth for quite a while.
Other colleagues of mine have spoken a lot about the housing market, including recently, which we, we've spent a lot of time analysing the distribution of debt in the economy and gaining some comfort from that compared to, say, the US housing market, and pointing out that some of the simple metrics which are used to assess the state of the housing market don't necessarily translate well across countries. One of the issues I mentioned earlier was, I talked quite a lot about in my speech, was leverage. Well, leverage in the Australian housing system is growing a lot slower than it did for most of the past decade. It's growing sort of 6-7% at the moment rather than 15%. So there was an interesting speech given by Charlie Bean at Jackson Hole on the weekend, and one of the things he talks about particularly is, you know, paying more attention to credit, which I think to some extent is something we've paid a reasonable amount of attention to here most of the time. So again, that's, you know, something we can, in assessing the state of the market at the moment, is something we're obviously looking at.
Dr. DeBell, Kai Chow from Sky News Business. Do you think that US economic risk has increased and the European sovereign risk has decreased to the extent that the former is now more of a concern for you? And my second question is, you mentioned the ratings agencies and how one of them in particular didn't even allow for negative house.
Well, that's an apocryphal reference in Michael Lewis's book, The Big Short, so I'm not sure how well that was. I'm sure the rating agencies would claim that was not true, but at least that was a story going around for a while.
Well, I'd be interested to know if you think that the rating agencies now, post-crisis, whether we can put a bit more faith in their risk assessment models as well.
As I said before, everyone got the risk assessment wrong. Well, not everyone, because at least not everyone did. But a lot of people got the risk assessment wrong, so I don't think they should be singling out rating agencies. I mean, if you look at the methodology has changed. I mean, amongst other things, you've now got a set of, as I said earlier, you've now got a set of observations which includes a 20% decline in house prices in the US. So your risk assessment on mortgage-backed securities in the future is going to be coloured by that, which wasn't something which was in your information set before 2007. As I said, at the moment, there are, you know, I think it's probably the case that their risks are greater at the moment than they've been. They're clearly greater at the moment than they were pre-2007. I'm not sure, you know, it's hard to say that, uncertain risk is fluctuating backwards and, you know, is fluctuating on a high frequency basis at the moment as to what markets tend to regard as the greatest risk. You know, at the moment, as you said, the focus tends to be more on the US. In May, the focus was more on Europe. At some point, it probably will switch again.
Where's your focus, though?
Everywhere, because that's what we're paid to do.
So. So it's not on one of those areas more than the other at the moment, though?
No, I think one point I'm trying to get across is that focusing too narrowly at any point in time is probably going to lead you astray. So it's basically always important to have as broad a focus as possible all the time, rather than just, you know, focused on what is, you know, if you think about a VAR model, it might, you know, some variance of it focuses on what the distribution of outcomes was in the last 20 days. So when you're setting policy or running a financial institution or whatever, you don't want to be focusing on just the most recent history. You want to be taking a much broader vision than that.
Andrew Dunn from Westpac. There's a lot of discussion around the level of risk that you can take in any bank, proprietary books or otherwise. The classic model is that intermediation smooths the flows, and that clearly didn't happen for a period of time. Is there any concern that switching off of institutions' desire or capability to take risk might exacerbate trade flows or other peak type of flows? That must be a difficult balance to reach.
The answer to this is that is not zero risk. So, you know, the leverage rules or the capital buffers still allow for a decent amount of leverage in the core financial system. The question is just ensuring there's not excessive leverage. And as I was saying earlier in answering the question here, obviously there's always cycles in risk taking. We're probably at somewhat of a, or at least have been recently at a somewhat of a low in that cycle. I mean, the other consideration which you have to take into account is in the Basel standards primarily apply to the banking system. So one of the issues is if you clamp down too much inside the regulated system, is all the risk taken then outside the financial system, and whether that is a good or a bad thing. What is a core financial system? What's a core financial institution, and what's a core financial system is a question which you would answer a lot differently today than you would have answered 10 years ago. In 10 years ago, you probably wouldn't have said that Bear Stearns or even Lehman Brothers was a core financial institution. Nowadays, the answer to that question is proven to be different. And so there is the issue that there will always be an appetite for leverage and for risk-taking, and the question is, as I said, ensuring that trying to make the system as robust as possible while recognising that's always going to be the case.
No, I'll exercise the chairman's right to ask the last question.
Okay.
I guess you mentioned Basel III in your comments, and certainly there seems to be an effort underway around the world to, perhaps long after the horse has already bolted, tighten the robustness of the global banking system. Certainly Australia, I think, is involved in the discussions isn't there a concern somewhere that, in fact, we're tightening at exactly the wrong time, which is to say, we're trying to improve the quality of financial institutions, improve their creditworthiness, improve their liquidity at exactly the time the same institutions should be core participants in the kickstarting of growth around the world? And do you have a general comment on that?
Well, that's something which is very much in the minds of the regulators, and you can see that in a lot of the standards have got a very long lead time. So they're being announced, but the implementation time is over quite a long period of time, which is very much taking into account the current conjuncture and coming to that assessment. So, yes, that is something which is very much uppermost in the minds of the people as they're framing those standards, is that, it is a difficult time, but that's, to some extent, a lot of the stuff which has been brought in place is to try and make the system more robust for the next event, which doesn't necessarily have too much implications for constraining things as they are at the moment. But as I said, one of the main mechanisms to take account of that sort of concern is by, while these standards are being announced now, is making sure that the lead times are enough so as not to adversely affect the macroeconomic outlook.